Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million, if I had
Hello, and welcome back to Snacks and Jacks. I'm Tomorrow Andrew on the board. S&P futures up 53. NASDAQ futures up 295. You might say, how could that be? Well, because right on the close yesterday when Microsoft's earnings came out, we were down more than that. So we're doing the bounce back here. We're not exactly sure why, because that's what we do. We buy the dip. Not saying we shouldn't, by the way. I'm not giving advice, but the NASDAQ was down. Actually, the futures are down 3-something last night at one point, and they came back some, but Microsoft's only down 12. It was down like 35, maybe pushing 40 at one point. So it's a very strange market. They came out and said they weren't making any money really on the AI. Despite the huge investment and kind of torpedoed the stock, but of course, everybody rallied to the rescue and everybody, bought back in. So we're doing that, but these kind of moves, part of it is market fabric. You know, there's not a whole lot of people, in the way after close like that. But it's still not these kinds of moves up and down. It's not indicative of a real healthy market. I mean, your long bull markets usually are, they crawl, always to the upside. It's relentless. But this is strange. These kinds of moves in these stocks, we're talking, hundreds of billions of dollars in a swing in terms of market cap. I mean, that's pretty serious stuff. Do we have Professor Kevin?
Good morning.
How are you? Did you buy?
All right.
Did you buy
So tell me this: is there a chance that this is just what's going to be normal going forward? That that we are going to just lurch around and that's that's what the and you have to follow a trend line through it. Is that what's going to be normal or do you see us ever going back to something that resembles normal? Because you're right. I wouldn't expect. What's a stock? We're supposed to be valuing the company somehow,
right.
Some way. Can the value really jump around like that? That doesn't seem to make sense on a day in, day out basis. I agree it's unusual. The question is it the way it's going to be for the foreseeable future?
Well, Microsoft has 7.5 billion shares outstanding, 7.431 to be exact. So when you start flipping $30 is around, you're talking about $230 billion in market cap, which is, and you'll hear...
Which makes no sense when you think about that the market cap, based on a few hours ago, is that substantially different.
Well, you're also at a number where people can't even... That's why, I'll find this out today, I promise, but the... I know the total market cap of Russell is like it might be up. It's been up, so let's say 70 billion. So you'll hear somebody on TV or whatever. It's not that. Well, I keep saying that, but people will tell you stuff, but they won't tell you the back story. They'll say, "Well, high tech is down," or like it's okay. The Dow's up, and oh by the way, the Russell's up. Well. The Microsoft flipped 3 times the market cap of the entire Russell. It's not even, we're not even talking about apples and oranges, we're not even talking about apples and grapes. I mean, it is hard for anybody. I tell you what, it has to be hard for anybody. Well, you don't want to judge everybody by yourself. But I've been doing this a long time. I cannot conceive of of $230 or $260 billion worth of flip in 20 minutes in a market value of a place. First of all, I can't conceive of some place being worth $3 trillion in the first place. Explain to me exactly what $3 trillion looks like. I have no idea. I mean, we're talking about numbers that if somebody had to pay for the place, it's like, you know, it's like, all right, I'm getting like Jimmy Stewart. I'm not an actor. I'm not famous, but you got to tell a story with a story. There was a one of the guys when I first started the business. He started trading. The clearing firm guy must have liked him, but the kid was kind of screw up out of the gate. But he had some money, right? So he started with like $12,000 in his account, which you could. I started with $10,000 in mine, and so the kid lost like $500 or something, and he was underneath the minimum. So the clearing firm guy goes, okay, well, you need to bring $500 in tomorrow. And he goes, yeah, well, that's no problem. No, I want $500. I don't want a check. Check's too easy. Might be your dad's money or something. I want $500. The guy looked at him like, what are you talking about? I mean, what is... I keep talking about the lady who bought the Mark Cuban's part of his basketball team. If she had to bring in whatever, what was it, $5 billion or $3 billion or whatever number, it wasn't five, it was $1 or $2 billion.
Big number, though.
Yeah, but how do you, I mean, what if she had to bring that in a briefcase? I mean, does she have any idea how much that even is? Does anybody? I don't. Could you even fit it in a Brinks truck? $100 bills?
Well, yeah, actually, it's surprising how little the stack is. Because way back a long time ago, we had in my banking days, they had like this family day on a Saturday where you could come in, and one of the things that they wanted to have for, you know, for the kids to view was in the vault, locked in the vault behind the you know, where you couldn't get in, $1 million sitting there. And it turned out they had to do like $1 million in ones and fives just for it to look like anything.
Well, but we're way past $1 million though.
Oh, I know. What I'm saying is, if you put it in hundreds, you know, it's a surprisingly small stack of bills.
It is.
Trust me on this.
You know,
still more than I would shake a stick at, but nevertheless, it's.
I'm trying to find this here, and I'm not so good on searching here. Like you probably already have it. Remember when we were paying off the Taliban, trying to buy them over to our side back in the Afghanistan days? How screwed up that was. I actually read an article about how much of cash you can get on a C-130 in $100 bills. It was a number. It was, you know, many millions, but it wasn't a billion or anything.
Yeah, and I don't think we were buying off the Taliban. We were buying off the warlords.
Weren't they the same? Whatever, we were buying off the bad guys.
Yeah, some of them, there was probably some overlap there.
Yeah, I'd say so. Mike Murphy, our guest, his son was doing some of that over there. He was a liaison to the bad guys for a while, and I think he was involved in some of the negotiating some of the transactions. Interesting story. If you ever get a chance to meet him, he's a really good kid. Did a lot of. I mean, I'm not sure if he's still in the Army or not. We'll have Mike on someday, and he'll tell us one way or the other. But yeah, he was in intelligence, and he was. But anyway, there's a finite number of $100 bills you can put on a C-130. It was a lot, but it wasn't like, you know, $5 billion or anything. Just how would somebody like to pull up in your driveway to C-130 and say, "Here's your cash, Kevin."
Dying to see the plane that could land in my driveway, but sure.
Yeah. You ever see one of those vertical takeoff and landing things?
I have not seen one in person, no.
When they had the air show here, back before Mayor Daley ripped up Meg's Field, you know, all the bigger jets they'd have up at the Glenview was not closed then. They used to put them up there. Now they use I think they use Gary now. But the Harriers would land at Meg's Field. You could walk out there and walk around the darn things. And they weren't very big. They were pretty cool looking. They weren't big. They just, you know, but they put those things pointing downward and up the thing would go and then off the thing would take off, right?
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, I saw True Lies. I know how they work, damn it.
Oh, God. So, yeah, I mean, these numbers, I mean, you ask the question, whenever that kind of market volatility where a stock's worth, you know, 100 one day, oh no, it's by the dip, and now it's 105, and then it's the other. It is not really a sign of a I won't say healthy, because the market's still valued high, but it leads you to believe that people are not sure of the pricing. Because right now we're talking about Microsoft, well, I just had it up here, but how many shares there were outstanding. But I'll look and see how much is what their PE ratio. I had them on my little calculation here that I did on my sheets of paper. Of course, they're buried all over my desk. I had Microsoft with 13.4 times revenue. This is when the stock was probably a little lower than here. But anytime you have a stock of that magnitude, I mean, when all the stocks in the 2000 crashed, Cisco and all those things, they kind of just made it to over 10 times revenue. Anytime a stock's over 10 times revenue, it better be something that's really growing, something, I mean, maybe an NVIDIA a few years ago, or even maybe not that long ago, that actually is growing every year, something that's doubling. And it's easy to, not easy, but if you can raise prices in some sort of a time, you can kick your profits up, or you can have a bad year and have your profits down. But the amount of revenue, I mean, the cash coming in, the amount of revenue is something that's real, is key, right? And when you start talking about a stock, and you can't hide the revenue number. Like I said, the earnings number can go up and down on how much you're investing and what your expenses you're picking up and things. But when you start talking about a revenue, I mean, how does Microsoft double? The only way it might be going to double is that the amount of dollars doubles, so it looks like Microsoft revenue doubled because they can raise prices. I mean, I know I talk about this.
Oh, it also doubles the way, and Carl's brought this up a few times too. It can double if you stop selling Microsoft Office to people, as you know, you buy the software one time and you use it as long as you want, and it might get a little outdated, and so that's when you replace it. Or if they force you to buy Office 365 and you have to pay an annual subscription, that's a way to raise your revenue. So, you know, it's also a way to open the door for competitors, but you know, which is, you know, sort of, which is a variation on the Blockbuster Video theme, but nevertheless, you know, that's a way to raise it. So I think you have to look at it, because my understanding is that their cloud stuff was down. The Microsoft Azure, yeah, stuff was down. I'd have to look and see what was up, but you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it's subscription software.
Well, you know, but that's kind of a nobody wants to replay Stocks and Jack shows, but if you went back, we first started maybe 8 to 10 years ago. And one of my themes was I could sense these monopolies sort of building, you know. It was longer ago than that, when you started seeing most of your, you know, your local lumber yards, you know, go south, and Home Depot bigger and bigger piece, and you started to see, you know, Amazon taking over a lot of stuff. And I was always ragging about how they grew because somehow or another people avoided paying taxes through Amazon. Now, most of those loopholes have been closed, probably not all, but some. And but it's really kind of no way to, that my point was, these people were amassing this monopoly power. Microsoft, I mean, they were essentially, anything you did in business, even if there were competitors, and somebody like you is smart enough to find a competitor or something, or Google, you know, they put MapQuest out of business pretty much, right? And Microsoft put WordPerfect out of business, pretty much, right? I mean, you could still probably use them or find somebody else, but most people, if you're in office, you just do what everybody else does. And if the office is paying for Microsoft Office, guess what? You're going to use Microsoft Office. I mean, it's just, but they at the time, it didn't seem to me like those companies even understood the monopoly power they had, and to the point where it didn't seem to me like they were using it, you know. Now all of a sudden, as things have gotten tighter, and you know, we've had some people not get a lot of raises and those kinds of things, you can sense them all using this monopoly power, like Carl's talking about. Well, you can't buy it one time, you got to buy it every month. Oh, by the way, the stuff that you bought, it, even though they're your paintings or your stuff, unless you pay us every month, you don't get to use your own stuff. You know, think all that kind of stuff is exactly what you would expect when somebody becomes a monopolist. It takes them a while to figure out what power they have. You know, I mean,
it is the full reason why we have antitrust legislation, though, is because of the predictable behavior.
People don't change. I mean, it's not like these guys act any different than the railroad people did in the 1870s. I mean, it's just anytime you have monopoly power, you use it. I mean, it may be boring to most, but looking at the history of railroads in the first 50 years, maybe even the first 20 years, is an absolute, absolute is a it's a history and it's a learning piece on businessmen and what power can bring to people and what money does. Every dirty trick that you can ever dream of today was thought up by those guys. I mean, you look at the Enron situation where the executives in Enron started to splinter off parts of the company so that where they were a bigger percentage of the ownership there than they were in Enron. So even though Enron was making a bunch of money, some of the power might maybe went through another firm first and came to them, and the people that owned Enron, the executives owned 80% of the new company. That sort of thing. Well, damn it. The railroads that went across the country, it was the Union Pacific that went west and the Central Pacific that came east from Sacramento, and they met at Promontory Point in Utah. Everybody should know that. The one coming this way, Central Pacific, maybe even the Union Pacific, it wasn't long into the fray where there was all this money for the Union Pacific, say, and they had all this stock, and they're getting money to, you know, they got all this land that they could sell. Plus, I think they got some other dough from the government or something. But, they then formed another company to actually build the track, and they paid that company more than they were supposed to. So that company became very wealthy, and the original Union Pacific or the Central Pacific went bankrupt. But the new company was now owned by more of the insiders. And so the first guys are like out of luck, and you go, wait a minute, there's a railroad, it's making dough. Yeah, but it's not your railroad anymore. Well, it's the same thing that happened in Enron, the same thing happened in other places. I mean, these tricks, it's almost like try as you might, you can't invent a new fetish. somebody's already done it before.
But I'm working on that.
Well, you know, they didn't have electric back then, so maybe you could go that route. But one guy, we had to read the Kama Sutra in high school, and everybody bought the abridged version, except one kid. I don't know what happened. He ended up with the unabridged version. Did you ever see that? I think it's a Kama Sutra.
I'll take your word for it.
But it's like 40 pages of positions to do sex in. And believe me, you got to be somebody who works for the Cirque du Soleil to be able to do 90% of them. these people were flexible. Anyway, but yeah, you start to see this flexing of monopoly power, and I think that our you know, people that are running the government, I think it's just we're not casting any aspersions on anybody. Just say the skill set to get in the job is not the skill set you want in the job. I mean, I'll use an example of Adlai Stevenson. Adlai Stevenson was a very intellectual guy because his father was very popular in Illinois. The son gets elected, right? He could have been the best senator we ever had. Yet nobody knew. I mean, he'd go like Mike Royko used to say. The guy would sit there and he'd write these position papers on very complex subjects and send them out to all the other people in the Senate. Everybody respected the guy like there's no tomorrow, yet nobody thought he did anything because he wasn't on TV all the time, didn't give crazy speeches.
Oh, and he had the, the personality of a
as a college professor.
Let's revisit that notion.
Well, I mean, you did a lot of, you know what I'm talking about. He was an academic guy. You and Russell, you guys have done so much stuff outside the business. You're not the typecast. The guys at the University of Chicago never got out of the building. Some of them. I mean, they were just theorists. That's all they did. They were great guys. They would talk, and once in a while they'd go out and have a beer and enjoy themselves, but that was about it. I mean, they never were. I'm not saying all of them, but you know what I'm talking about. It's not. It was not meant to be an insult at all. But you and Russell
okay.
do everything.
That's okay. That's yeah. okay. I took umbrage, and we were done.
You and Russell are sort
I
of.
I just had a student as we took at our after our last class. Said, you really made it fun to come to class. So.
Well, yeah, because. Well, I mean, how many guys you know are like Russell, where they're worldwide traveler, a consultant on whole parts of the business, written a couple books on volatility. I mean, he's not your regular guy, right?
Oh no,
yeah.
Definitely not.
So, anyway, what I'm saying is we don't seem to have the sense of what's going on. I mean, I can't imagine somebody bringing an antitrust case regarding, I'll use the term, the creep of the Microsoft and all the other places that now this is your material and they're not going to give it to you unless you continue to pay them. I can't even imagine a prosecutor understanding that creep and bringing it to any kind of a court where the judge, maybe the judge might understand it was explained to him properly, but they're so far past any ability to control them, in my mind. And I don't know how you do it, Kevin. I really don't. I mean,
speaking of Microsoft and creeps, did you see the latest pronouncement from Gates?
No. What do you do now?
Well, the COVID came from bats, and the reason it's spreading to bats is because of climate change. We're encroaching on their habitats.
Well, well, you know, I...
It was, you know, unbelievable.
What are these guys... You know, if all of a sudden one of us made like $3 billion, something landed on us, I don't know what could land on us, but, and we gave a new dorm or something, University of Notre Dame, are we buying indulgences? What are we doing? Are we trying to convince ourselves that we're really good people, or are we trying to convince other people?
I think Gates is just trying to make the case for his investments, making him a fortune beyond the dreams of avarice. Think of Chinatown and John Huston looking at Jack Nicholson because Nicholson's character is Jake Gittes is asking him, you know, what more could you possibly want? You're already rich. And he says, the future, Mr. Gittes. I want to own the future.
Well, one of the guys just sent me a percentage drop since July 10th. NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon. No, it's not a lot. Not a lot. It's 23% NVIDIA. These are all from the top. So, I mean, it's not from a spot where most people bought it, but somebody did. 23%, Microsoft 15, Amazon 12, Google 12, Apple 9, Meta 18, and Tesla 19. Guess what that adds up to, Kevin, in terms of market cap lost?
About $100.
How does $2.6 trillion grab you? That's kind of a lot.
It's a price, yeah.
Yeah, but it's
a little stack of money.
Again, if anybody even knew what a trillion was, you know, I remember when you were a kid and nobody had a whole lot of dough. All of a sudden, somebody popped out 100, and you go, "Wow, it's 100!" No, you can blow through 100 at a deli counter, for God's sake.
Well, no kidding. Yeah, no kidding. Or at a family restaurant, going out for breakfast for two.
What did you think of a conversation yesterday with Hal? We can see what's happening, you know, the spread in terms of the haves and the have-nots. And it's growing seemingly dramatically. And the inflation, the Fed clearly has now adopted wealth maintenance as, I'm not saying they shouldn't, by the way. I wouldn't want to be the guy that went in there and just all of a sudden cut the market in half. I mean, I don't know if that helps anything either. It certainly didn't help me or my clients. You have to think that there's somewhat of a fix. And I'm not going to go back to we can't go back to the 60s or the early 70s when all groups of society seem to be moving forward at somewhat of the same pace. That you didn't see the CEO making 1,000 times the worker. It was more like 10 times the worker. That kind of thing, maybe 12. You didn't see, the stocks didn't go too far because you had some inflation, but you made money. But if you made a dividend in a stock you made 7% a year, I mean, you were happy. Now, some clients, not for me, but some other places I've been, if one part of the market's up 5% that month and you weren't in that part, you're not doing your job. Not to mention the fact if it shifts to another spot the next month, why should have been there this month? I had one guy years ago before I reached the point that I could really only take the clients that I wanted. One guy says to me, you're not doing so hot. And I go, well, what do you mean? The market was down 10 and we're actually up like 2 or 3. What are you talking about? And, if I'd have bought a couple of houses, I'd be way up. And I said, well, you gave me limited power of attorney to trade your account, which I think I've done responsibly. I don't think I could responsibly pull a check out of here for 100 grand and go buy a house. I don't think compliance, morality, my own morality, or anything would allow me to do that. Yeah, well, maybe you should have. I go, no, that's your decision. If you want to buy two houses, go buy two houses. But don't expect me to maintain your stuff in some sort of a protected area where the market's not doing so hot, but you're doing okay. And say, well, gee, if I would have bought a baseball card, I'd have done better. Well, I don't have the ability. First of all, I don't know anything about baseball cards. And secondly, I don't have the ability to buy it out of your account. Oh, yeah, well, maybe we should change that. No. Even if we could, I want no
part. Please don't.
Please don't. What are you doing? I mean, everybody gets this idea that they're chasing everything. And the thing that's the hardest to do is if you have somebody, if you have a stock that you bought at 10 bucks and you sold it at 30, and all of a sudden it goes to 32, you think you lost $2. No, you didn't. Just get it off your screen. What are you doing? I mean, just ask yourself, you got some jamoke like me with probably 200 stocks sitting on my screens in front of me. Every day, some are up, some are down. Imagine, I'd be more mentally screwed up than I am if I were to say, oh man, what is this morning? Dow's up 65 cents. Man, I should have been long Dow. Oops, I got United Health down 15. Why didn't I buy puts last night? God, if you just went up and down the page like that, you wouldn't last till 10 before you jumped out the window, would you?
Maybe the lottery paid off, I don't know how many millions, 100 million last night. I don't know if it did or not. I haven't looked. But why didn't I buy a lottery ticket? I'm sure I would have had that number.
Well, if you complain
that's just extending the same point of view.
Remember the old joke about the guy who said, God, you got to do me just one favor. And God says, well, what's that? He goes, I need to win the lottery. And God says, Saul, you got to meet me halfway. You got to buy a ticket. So anyway, one of the things that I'd like to talk about, Kevin, and we see this. I use the term. We should probably go to break because I want to get to
break. We got to hit baseball.
That's what I wanted to do. Say baseball and talk about when you start paying people the kind of money they're paying people in football and baseball, and we start talking about buying pieces of teams that are now we're talking about billions of dollars. What is their view of the world going forward versus other people? Because they didn't make any kind of investment on that, you would think, unless it's just such a monopoly-powered boys' club sort of thing that you'll pay anything to get in there. It might be that. But by and large, you have to sit there and say, okay, if I do this, ticket prices are going to be X 5 years from now, X 10 years from now. My expenses are going to be this. I'm actually going to be able to write this, $300 million interest check every year. What do I got to do to get there? And I don't know if they're going through the analysis or they're not, or they're just convinced that those kinds of assets go up all the time. Be careful with that one. But let's talk about it. S&P futures up 51, NASDAQ futures up 284, bouncing back huge from the big rundown we had last night because of Microsoft's earnings. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. S&P futures are up 51. NASDAQ futures up 291. So it looks impressive, except we were down that much on the close last night, and we're just kind of bouncing back. So we're sort of all over the place. Dow futures up 52. Microsoft, I have it down 15 bucks. It was down, I'm thinking, 35 last night at one point. United Health down 16 in the Dow. But then we had Boeing up 3. They had earnings. And Caterpillar was up 3. Caterpillar's been all over the place. There's another kind of a interest-sensitive, economy-sensitive stock, and it's had a big run-up. Then it ran down. Now it's running up. So there's stuff moving, like I said earlier. Renesia, these guys have been up and down, up and down. Nikkei up 575 last night. That's 1.5%, 39,105. Central Bank raises their benchmark rate. Aussie shares hit an all-time high. So, like I said, this stuff is scattered. Hang Seng up 341, well over 17,000 now. 17,344, that's 2%. Shanghai up 59, that's another 2%. So, Japanese raising the interest rates. They raised them from like 0.1 to 0.25, so, but they're stopping some of their bond buying. They've been buying their own bonds, the central bank, so they're cutting back on that, so they're trying to get back to more of a normal situation, but they're a long way from normal. Over in Europe, DAX up 78.4%, FTSE down up 99, 1.2%, CAC around up 91.2. If you didn't realize how much we went down on the close last night, you'd think this was a beautiful morning. What is compared to the close? Yesterday, the Dow was up 203, S&P down 27, NASDAQ down 222. The futures are down more than that. Bonds. 10-year, 4.13 unchanged. The Bund down 2 basis points, 2.32. Japan up 5 to 1.05. It really was there a couple of weeks ago. So they're right back to where they were, even though they made this announcement. Oil up 257, but still only 77.30. They've gotten down below 75 bucks, which was $8, 10, 12% more lower than it was a few weeks ago. Brent up 218, 80.81. I mean, all this stuff's kind of moving around. Natural gas up a penny, 214. RBOB up 5 cents, 244. Gold, which has been going crazy here too. We were under 2,300 yesterday, and now we're 2,463, up 11 today, but it really shot up yesterday afternoon. Silver up 24 cents, 28.77. Copper up 77 cents, 415. The U.S. dollar is still at 108.4 against the euro. It's unchanged against the pound, but here we've got the Japanese yen at 150 now. So it was 163 to the dollar. Now it's down to 150. So it strengthened dramatically in the last couple of weeks. So it's 2.5% move in a currency is a big move. Crypto, Bitcoin's up 248 to 66,069. Kevin, while we're doing traffic, weather, sports, just imagine if you would have bought you use the dollar to buy yen, to buy in the Japanese market. All of a sudden now you made money on the yen, right? Well, it doesn't matter if you made any money on the market. It's crazy. What do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports?
All right, it is 6:39 here in Chicago on Wednesday, July 31st. A little bit of baseball here. The Cubs lost to the Reds yesterday, 3-6. The White Sox lost to the Royals, 4-3. But the Diamondbacks won over the Nationals, 0-17. Over for Chicago weather, it is currently 72 degrees. We're going to get warm and humid today as temperatures reach up to about 88 to 90 degrees. We have a light chance of showers throughout the day. It's going to hit in the afternoon starting at about 2 p.m. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 87 degrees. They're mostly sunny and hot today. As always, danger of overheating throughout the day as high temperatures hit 110. And finally, for Chicago traffic, there are thankfully no major accidents to report on the inbound expressways. Traffic is building a little bit on the Kennedy and on the Eisenhower. But other than that, things look okay for now. That is all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Well, Kevin, what do you make of that, a 2.5% move in a currency?
Well, what is to make of it? It's that's just crazy.
Yeah, I mean it's if you just bought,
if you're looking at it, you know, the value of your currency just changed by 2.5%.
That's
that's not supposed to happen like in a day.
No. Well, so let's see. If you were buying yen, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, you could get for your dollar, you could get 163 yen. And now, you can give 150 yen to get your dollar back, and you've got 13 yen left. That's crazy. In that length of time.
Yeah, it really is. So, what do you think? We're talking about that. We're talking about Microsoft. We're talking about stocks and their valuations changing virtually overnight, and sometimes within the, a window of a few hours. Are there people powerful enough to really make that move? I tend to think yes. You know, it might not be one individual, but it could be a small group of individuals, because somebody's making a lot of money off of this. Somebody's on it.
How can I explain it without being a conspiracy nut job? It's if there's an announcement, because people are get caught long, get caught short, depending on, usually get caught long. Well, you get caught long if it goes down, right? If somebody gives some kind of announcement or there's news out there, especially in a market now, we don't have any central point of trade like we used to have the New York Stock Exchange or the Chicago Board Options Exchange, where there was a central point where people felt comfortable enough in the system to have standing orders in kind of one spot. And a lot of market makers, they didn't have the combined capital to sit it over people, so I'm not saying that there was more capital in the system, there wasn't. But you had a combined spot where people felt comfortable if IBM was trading, it's 191.99 this morning. If you want to sell it at 193, you could put an order in with the specialist and it'll be on the book. So there was a lot of stuff available just away from the markets. There was bids below and offers above. But now, because the stuff is scattered all over the place, those offers and bids necessarily aren't even real orders. They might be a computer orders. And the minute some piece of news comes out, they're all pulled. So if you want to buy 10,000 shares of IBM, instead of paying up, 50 cents, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon after earnings, you might be paying up $3. So unless you have some kind of a feel of the fabric of the market, things are going to be extended anyway. But if you have news that is, let's say, that is market moving, and without getting into names, a lot of the stuff that Musk says is market moving. How the guy, I'm not saying he should be in jail, but how the guy gets away with it, I have no idea. Just because of his size and because, clearly this stuff when he was going to buy his company and then he didn't, that kind of stuff. What Trump says a lot of times is market moving. What, not just him, what other politicians say is market moving. What the Fed says is market moving, and why they have to go give these speeches. And they sort of know that, but if you have any kind of, get the news a little bit early, and all of a sudden say it's a Microsoft, then if you knew the numbers were not that good, and you could get yourself a short position when you start selling beforehand, and all of a sudden the news comes out that's bad, now all the people you sold to have become sellers. And take a simple market making standard. I'm just a schlump in the OEX pit. So somebody comes in, what's your market on these things? 2 to 1/8. Okay, I'll buy 20. All right. 5 minutes later, what's your market? 2 and a teeny, 3 teenies. All right, I'll buy 20. All of a sudden now, where are you now? Well, I'm 2 and 1/8 a quarter. I'll buy another 20. All of a sudden now, another 20 or another 2 or 3 of these guys, or somebody wants 100 lot, I might be 2 3/8 bid just to save my skin. So now I ended up, I start out being just somebody making a market. Now all of a sudden I'm a panic buyer because I just made 5 trades all the same direction. Now it's going against me. I'm 2 3/8 bid. I'll be happy to take a quarter offer on this thing to save my skin. So if any kind of somebody gets wind of it early, especially with the market being as decentralized as it is now, you can turn people into buyers or sellers just by being in there first, and they're chasing their own position, which makes these moves a lot worse than they normally would be. Is what I'm saying. I mean, I don't, it's hard for people to understand that, but you start out the day without a position. There's people right now. I know people that are big. They call it order market providers, where they're making markets and everything all day long. In some kind of a big move day, I'll have a drink with some of these guys, and they go, "We had a horrible day," because all of a sudden people started buying all this stuff. They just were selling them because that's what they do, and trying to hedge as best they can. And all of a sudden they couldn't hedge fast enough, and they become a buyer, and the thing runs right up their behind. I mean, last night Microsoft being down 30 some bucks. Kevin, that's a move in Microsoft, for God's sake.
Yeah. So I guess my question then would be, are there people who are really, really good at manipulating the markets to their favor, or is it really just that some people are more astute and quicker to react than everybody else?
I'm going to say in today's world, the people who are supposed to be making the markets also see the orders as they come in. In my day, you had no idea what the broker next to you was going to get. So if you knew, in other words, if I was the only guy in the OEX and I knew the order coming from the desk for Pershing was a buyer of 200 puts, guess what? My market on the puts all of a sudden is going to go from 2 1/8 to maybe 2 1/8 3/8 or more than that, right? Because I know they used to use the term on the floor, do you want me to give you a buy market or a sell market, right? I mean, these little phrases, they sound trite, but they're not. So if you know that all of a sudden, and they get looked, that's what they're paying for. That's why there's payment for order flow, Kevin, is because the customer is no longer you. The customer is now the person who's on the other side of the trade. So you're going to let him know what you've got, so he gets a chance to dance a little bit, which is a problem. But if you get your stuff for free or cheap, you think you've got the world by the oyster. No, they got you by the cojones. It's a different. You just don't get it. There is no such thing as free, right? But hey, let's get back to the baseball world. We got 12 minutes, and back in my younger days, Kevin, and I don't even know if people know that this is the procedure these days. But if somebody were to say, "Hey, Kevin," "Hey, Chief," "Hey, Andrew," I don't know if they do it to Andrew. He need a little work first, but I'm thinking about, railroad car production and, what about this new plant that's available? What do you think? Okay, now you and I are going to sit there and go, all right, wait a minute. That means we can now produce, instead of 500 railroad cars a year, these are freight cars, nobody produces 500 passenger cars. Now, is the market going to be good for 600? Because that's what we can produce out of this new place. Is the market growing? Or isn't it? Are the prices going to stay the same, or are they coming down? Is some railroad going under? Do all of a sudden there's all these used boxcars, use the term boxcars, going to be available? You have to go through this whole routine of price. What's going to cost to fix this place up? Are we going to put any new mechanisms in there? Are we going to have, before robots? How many people is it going to take? What's the overhead number? And you're going to go through there, and you're going to try and figure out whether this is profitable 10 years down the road. What's the economy going to look like? Is the economy going to grow 2% a year? Are we actually going to sell, there's a million boxcars out there. Does that mean that they all have a 40-year life? Does that mean we're going to sell 2,500 boxcars next year? You got to go through all this, because it's real money. Because you're not getting the money for free like maybe you can now. We were paying 10% in those days. So if Pullman ponied up or borrowed $200 million for this place, boy, that's $20 million a year. You better cover right out of the gate, right? So there's a whole process to do this, but it's no different than paying a third baseman or a quarterback for 5 years. What is the TV contract going to look like? What are the people in the stands? Are people going to have money to pay? 5 years from now, the best tickets are going to be $400 a game. Okay. Because now they're $200 at some of these new places. Is $400 realistic? Can we get 65,000 people that can pony up that kind of money every week? Or is it all going to be corporate stuff? Is it still going to be deductible? Is it deductible even now? Or it is, I guess, if you go with somebody. All these things enter into it before you say, yeah, I'll pay DJ Moore that kind of money for 5 years. I mean, I wonder what their process, their view of the world is, saying that this is all a go, that everything is just going to, when you and I see kind of maybe some people getting laid off and people not going out 3 nights a week, spending $20 at the bar. I mean, so I just wonder what their view of the world is, and if it's, maybe it's right. Maybe they are correct. We're in their niche. Even if people are hunkered down in their house, they're all going to sit there and watch football. But then again, your advertiser is going to be Cadillac, and nobody can afford a Cadillac, is it going to be worth it for Cadillac? I mean, the thought process for these guys to do this correctly, and I'm not saying they're not. They got a whole bunch of money. They probably got some really good people working there. What do you think it even looks like? What do you think their view of the world is 5 years from now, and maybe somebody else? I mean, I'd love to be in on one of those meetings, wouldn't you?
I would. So first of all, you just reached absolute Chet Kopic on asking a question that takes 5 minutes.
Yep.
So good job on that. Actually, from everything that I have ever read, and I haven't read anything in a while, but they do have financial models, and you know, based on the total payroll, some predictive stuff for what the models look like. And I think that's, you know, that's a good thing. That's a good way to run the business. But that, you know, that way they can they decide what they're going to be able to afford based on what they think the incoming cash flow is going to look like. And I do think they operate strictly on a cash basis, not a profitability basis. That's just different. You know, for these, because they're all individually owned, profitability is only about taxes. So it doesn't have anything to do with the cash flow. In some cases, I think, you know, you have people who worry less about that than they worry about valuation of their franchise. But I think those valuations could crash at any time, depending on what else happens in the economy. So that's a big risk. And for all I know, they have it all hedged out and it's all going to be fine for them. But for the most part, it's cash flows. They want to know what the revenue prediction is, so that they know what size of payroll, and then it becomes up to the general manager to allocate the payroll in a way that the team will be competitive to ensure that people actually buy tickets and come out to watch the games. Is that a reasonable summary in your mind?
Well, it is, but what if let's take the Bears case, the Bears are paying $6 million a year, which is nowhere near enough to carry the debt load on Soldier Field, which is built essentially for them. Now, you have some concerts, you have some other stuff, I get that. But now they're looking for another place, leaving Soldier Field debt-ridden. And if we get some kind of a real recession, I mean, if I'm the governor, I might say, you know what, not only are we not giving you a dime for any stadium, but your contract is up in 2 years, that rent is now going to be 25. Or 20, because that's the
market value of the rent.
That's the market value of the rent. And I know people, you know, a few years ago, they were paying, they had the skybox, the best skybox, 50-yard line. It was $2,000 a ticket. This was 6 years ago, Kevin. It's probably more now. I mean, now the person used it to bring every politician he could, because he got into... he was doing all the, you know, the bond issues and things like that. What if all that got cleaned up? And say, you know, we can't do that anymore in Chicago. We're broke. You know, we're not feeding anybody any of these things just because they take somebody to a football game or something. And all of a sudden, somebody goes, I can't pay 20 grand a week for tickets, or 40, or whatever the hell it is. It's crazy. Not to mention, it doesn't even include the beer and the ribs.
It is absolutely crazy, and the best thing they have going for them is scarcity.
Yeah.
So as long as they have a waiting list, they're okay, and so good for them. That's fine. But the problem, of course, with that is that it can dry up. And, you know, when we start talking about income disparities and so on, because, I mean, think about this. For you and me, what's the cost of watching the Bears?
Well, they're still on free TV, so I guess nothing.
Yeah, they're mostly on free TV. A little annoying sometimes when they're on something where you have to do a subscription, if they put them on Apple TV or Amazon Prime or something. But for the most part, I mean, the cost to us is near zero. At least the marginal cost is near zero.
But it wouldn't. So, it's not zero because we're buying stuff.
They don't have that problem. No, their next problem is the TV product is better as long as they have as long as they have a stadium that gives good background noise. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. But you definitely want a crowd there. But in the case of Soldier Field, that's a pretty small scarcity. What's it hold? 60,000-ish?
But it's brutal to get to and back. I mean, you really have to endure pain.
No, it's horrid, but in the Chicago area, in places as big as the Chicago area, you can find 60,000 people who will come to your football games, even at a ridiculous price. That might not be true as much in... Well, it is true in Green Bay because it's the whole state wants to go to Packers games, or if you want to talk like you're from Wisconsin, you just talk in the singular. It's Packers games or Packer games.
Yeah.
So the scarcity angle works for them, and then the vast amount of money they get from television. So now, what's your next question? Is that an infinitely growing revenue stream from media? And lately, yes. Indefinitely, I don't know, because we've already seen, for instance, what ESPN has been like over the past several years. The carnage for that, that for them, the money they're not making, and the fallout and the number of people they've had to cut loose and so on, is substantial. Are they really going to bid up the NFL? I don't know. Maybe they will. Maybe it's worth it to them. But boy, I'm not sure that gravy train is going to be chugging down the track forever.
Well, you look at the, and as you've been on longer than anybody. One of our themes here is everything affects everything else. And I'll use the Viagra example. Viagra, who was the other one? The one who had the smoke, the lady with the smoking hot luggage. The luggage that cost like $90 million. Was that Levitra? Or was it, what the hell was the other one? Cialis. And anyway, they were, when they went off patent, both of those products, I think the NFL lost, was it $40 or $50 million a year?
Yeah, but they have all these new drugs that they're advertising. Well,
that's my point. My point is, if all of a sudden, somebody listens to the Carls of the world and says, "Wait a minute, we're not going to have people making a drug for $5, the fatso drug, and charging $1,000 for it. That's not going to happen." So all of a sudden, we fix the patent laws, we do something where we're not just hosing everybody, and all of a sudden, that person can charge $50 for that drug instead of $1,000, or say $100. Let's be nice, 20 times what it costs them. I got news for you. That commercial is coming off of NFL, right? I mean, I don't think.
Well, yes and no, because I see ads on sports all the time for the new generics, the generic. I'll be nice and just say generic Viagra, generic Cialis, I won't be nice for boner pills.
Yeah.
So I see those ads on there all the time. So they are getting ad revenue off of it. I don't know if it's the same. I don't know if the amounts are the same. But it's definitely happening. So.
But I saw it happen to one. They went from $50 a pill to $5, and they went off CNBC and NFL. So I mean, I'm saying it could it happen to, the fat drugs if they have to drop down from $1,000. A shot to $100 a shot. Why wouldn't I think that the same thing might happen there? Or they probably won't. Let's put it this way: they won't be willing to pay the same amount. Would they still want to advertise? Yeah, but will they be in a local stuff? Will they be something different? Will they be doing?
Yeah, and I can't answer that. I don't know. I see the ads. I have no idea if they're I have no idea if they're getting anywhere near the revenue off of the generics that they were getting off of the.
But it's what I say. The topic we're dancing around, Kevin, is this is sort of monopoly money. You know, it's wealth growth money. It's patent money. It's something that nobody else has. I mean, you're not. You know, can a regular business afford $40,000 a week in a skybox tickets to take their buddies to? That's kind of a lot. You know, what causes? Who can pay that? Is it somebody who has an angle, or is it a regular person? And I think you're right. When you're talking about 65,000 people in 50 skyboxes in a city the size of Chicago, can you get 50 people with an angle that'll do it? The answer is probably yes. Now the question is, should football be that kind of a monopoly? I mean, should the current owners be able to sell a new franchise in Las Vegas for $5 billion? Why should they be able to sell that? Why shouldn't somebody be able to start it and say, I'm joining? I mean, it's...
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a closed society. So, yes, you do have that issue, don't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm saying there's issues. I guess, Mike, at some point, though, are they separating themselves so far from the rest of society that they don't even know they're doing it, and all of a sudden one day they're going to go, what the hell? You know, maybe. I don't know. Maybe not. You know, maybe the economy will pick up and it'll all be fine. But it seems like they're really zeroing in. I mean, I don't know that anybody who couldn't go to a ball game 30 years ago, and now I'm not paying that much. I mean, what am I going to do that for? I mean, look at Notre Dame seats. Really? Not to mention, what's the Morris Inn at night on weekends? 8:50.
Oh God, the local hotels, and what they're taking advantage of is, we've talked about this. Remember, it used to be a day trip, and I would think that most state schools are still a day trip. You know, Joel could probably tell us about Michigan and how that works, but Notre Dame has such a dispersed alumni base that they get these people to make the trip, you know, the annual track, and they can gouge on the tickets, and people can gouge on the hotel reservations, because nobody wants to buy the plane ticket and plan the trip unless they have everything lined up. So, you know, so that works out really well for everybody involved, except for the poor saps that have to pay the money.
Well, one of the guys who was the...
Then you get people like me who I just live here. If I want to go to the game, I can go to the game. There's not, you know, there's going to be cheap tickets available right the week of the game.
But, you know, I totally missed the part of going there and just buying the ticket in the parking lot. That to me, it was part of the fun.
Yeah, a little harder to do when they're electronic tickets. It's doable, but it's a little bit more difficult. Because you're right, as soon as they went all electronic, that kind of killed that market. Used to be that you could just, if you waited right until kickoff time, you know, somebody was saying, just give me $5 so I can feel like I got something.
Well, plus, as being a market maker at heart, everybody thinks I'm this conservative old grump, but the minute I would do is I'd immediately assess the situation. How many hands are toward you looking to buy it? How many tickets are up in the air looking to sell? You immediately get a feel for the market. You see more tickets in the air than hands pulling for you. You sit there going, let's wait this one out. But remember my buddy JD, we went down to the national championship game down in Arizona. Mm-hmm. So, and he was one of these guys, let's just get our tickets. Well, immediately we bought these tickets, and as we got closer to the stadium, I see some guy that really needed them. And I could see that everybody around us was selling. So the guy, I held the two tickets up in the air. I think we paid $20 for them. And the guy goes, hey, I need two tickets. And I go, the face on him was like 50. I said, I'll tell you what, we'll give them to you for 40. You just paid 20 for them. And the guy goes, I'll take them. So JD's like, you just sold our tickets. They weren't that good. Don't worry, we'll get better ones. And we did. But he was so horrified that I sold our tickets.
To give you an idea, what the market, it still works like that. It's just it's just a little less immediate. And by that I mean, a few years ago, I was visiting my son in Phoenix, and there was a college playoff game in there. It was Ohio State with Justin Fields and Clemson with You know the guy's name. He plays for Jacksonville.
Anyway,
it was their teams. So it was a good matchup. And I just said the day before the game, hey, Patrick, let's see what tickets cost. If they're reasonable, you want to go. I think we paid $110 a seat for four of us. That was for the club level.
Wow. How easy is it?
We were living it up on that one, and for only $110 a seat, just going on, I don't know if it was StubHub or what, but it was one of the markets.
How easy or safe is it if somebody says, yeah, there's only two of us, I got four of them on my phone, I'll kick you two. Are you sure you get them when you give the guy the dough?
You have to settle before the exchange allows the... before the state exchange allows the transaction to go through.
What do you mean settle?
Well, you have to actually have your hands on the ticket. It's supposed to be a verified electronic ticket. I am sure there are scams, but generally, the ticket sellers work real hard to have a viable system. Otherwise, they don't have a product to sell.
Well, I mean, you could if it's a guy supposed to have three of his buddies and he's only got one of his buddies and we're sitting next to him, he could just bring us in on his phone, right? If you and I went.
Yeah, if you met up there, you can do that. But that's not going to be listed on StubHub. That's not how they work.
Okay, because we had a real quick story. Here's how people can be so weird. We were negotiating, which we never bought, CBOE, we're negotiating to buy the Pacific Stock Exchange, right? So those guys were in here in Chicago, had this big meeting, and it's the playoff game where the Cubs are playing the Giants. So Bill Bratsky's the chairman, and I go, hey, Bill, if I get some tickets for tonight's game, you want me to get them and ask if these guys want to go? And he goes, yeah, don't worry, I'll pay you. Yeah. So I get really good tickets for Face because one of my best buddies played football in Michigan for this guy Frank Maloney, who used to be the Cub ticket guy. And there's all these tickets available every game in case, you know, some big shots show up. And there's always some left. So if you know the guy, it's at game time and will call, you can go get the ones that are left, and they're always good seats. And you have to pay, you know, Face price, and you can't scalp them because the last thing they want to hear is those things coming back being scalped. So I get nine or ten. And so all of a sudden, the guy who's the law firm for the guys from the Pecos go, we got our own tickets. Screw you. we don't want you taking it. You're liable to talk about the deal or something. So here I am stuck with like 10 tickets an hour before game time, right? So I go into the bar, which they got a bunch of guys in there. It looks just like the Cheers bar, right? I go, hey, do any of you guys want to go to the game? And all of a sudden they go, yeah, it looked just like Norm and Cliffy and everybody. They all get their drinks to go. We all pile in a cab, and up we go. So I get the tickets. I still got like four left. So there's this husband and wife trying to get in, and I go, he says, we're looking for tickets, and we can't pay these outrageous prices. I said, how about if I give them to you for free, and you buy a round of beers for everybody? I said, but you got to do one thing. I go, what's that? I said, you're walking in ahead of me, and I'm handing the guy your tickets. There's no way you're scalping these things. And the guy goes, you got a deal. So I actually brought a couple in for free. They were the nicest people from Indiana and wanted to go to the game. And the guy did buy two rounds of beer, so everybody was happy. And so we went in and watched the game. It was a great game. But, you know, they had them in your hot little hand, and you're sitting there going, the last thing I want to do is sell them to somebody who's going to turn around and scalp them, right? I mean,
yeah, you don't want to go, you're being a nice guy.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, yeah, because I've actually done that, you know, back in the days of hard copy tickets where, you know, somebody had a sob story. I said, yeah, here, just pay me what they're worth. And then I get into my seats and somebody entirely different is sitting there.
Well, we have Russell. He's going to he's now going to write a book on ticket scalping I have done at various stadiums, and he probably is a bestseller. What do you think?
Yeah, I think he'd probably write a great book on it.
Well, Russell,
what do you think, Russell?
He'd write a good book on anything, this guy. Russell, how are you? He's supposed to be in the room, according to Andrew. He probably muted himself.
It hurts when you do that.
I was driving and I dropped the phone.
Oh, God.
I had to pull into a parking lot at a really sketchy looking spa. What are these spas in the western suburbs? Good morning, gentlemen.
Just don't go in. If it says happy ending on a wall, turn around, walk out.
Yeah, I'm not going in there. No. I'm driving away quickly. I'm driving away quickly. My phone that's tracked, I stopped there for muting purposes.
I gotcha.
So there.
Oh, gotcha.
Which, by the way, real quick, because I forget this every week. 2 weeks ago, my wife's on her morning walk. She's walking around Prospect Park, and there's a gentleman walking the other way listening to us with a speaker.
Wow.
She's trying. She can't even get away from me on her morning walk.
Yeah, no matter how hard she tries.
Did she say that intelligent guy in there is my husband?
No, she said a grumpy-looking old guy like yourselves. No, she didn't describe him at all. Now I feel kind of bad when I said that, because the gentleman may be on his morning walk, and all of a sudden I said he looked grumpy. Nope, she just said that she just kind of saw a guy going. She heard our voices, which kind of freaked her out. You know,
that would.
And start to hear voices and whatnot. But somebody in my suburb was listening to us.
The guy's probably
just about a block and a half from where we are.
The guy's probably some buff ex-Olympic gymnast out there doing 50 chin-ups just to keep in shape and something. You know, we're calling him grumpy.
I'm going to just plead the fifth on this, because we're talking about a listener and they may actually be listening.
Hey, our listeners
are.
I'm going to say they're diverse.
Yeah, that's true. I've you know, had a handful of people periodically say they hear me on Stocks and Jocks.
I did get a
and they do come from all walks of life, for sure.
I did get an email from our buddy in Australia, who got the tickets.
Oh, wow.
Who got the tickets from Matty Weber for that Australian band that came here. Anyway, he said, "Boy, everybody over there is seriously pissed off about the outages and stuff from this CrowdStrike." You know, because they really screwed things up over there, airlines and everything else. And
it made it worse over there.
Well,
they've got more modern computers than Southwest.
Well, they were just pissed off as how it could happen. You know, I don't know what you do about that other than being pissed off. But they were not happy, and he said it was actually a lot worse than it was reported. They heard it was reported here. You know, it was all over the place. And by the way, what do you make of, well, Kevin's still here? Delta hired some. I don't recognize the guy's name, but apparently some big schmo lawyer to sue both CrowdStrike and Microsoft. What, Kevin? You're in on how those contracts are written. Do they have a leg to stand on, or no? Do you think?
It depends on their negotiating prowess. So I think I said this before. One of the things that you have to look for in your contracts are the consequential damages clauses, because everybody who sells you any kind of software, computer services, and so on is going to have a boilerplate contract that says they are not responsible for any consequential damages caused by use of their product, which means the damage to your business. All they are responsible for doing is giving you your money back for the service that they failed to perform. And so you have to push hard to get that overturned. It depends on your buying power. So there's a lot of people that'll just laugh you out of there. And I definitely understand that they don't want, they can't have an open checkbook for damages. You know, that's just too much of a risk for the business. And so it wouldn't be wise to do that. But in exchange for that, you need some insistence about their diligence, and to make sure that they, you know, at least follow their own procedures for controlling software upgrades, how they're tested and how they're implemented. They at least have to follow their own procedures, but you should probably try to get industry standards.
What, back when I was doing contracts for railroad cars, when you had schedules and stuff, the product obviously had its own kind of guarantee, but the schedules, you had to call, what do they call these, Russell? It was all clauses in there. If there was a strike, there was a war, there was a hurricane.
They would call them act of God.
Yeah.
Act of gods. But I don't know if somebody's software upgrade counts as an act of God.
Well, what I'm getting to is that the government has sort of mandated all these rules for these airlines. In other words, if Delta shuts down because of CrowdStrike, now they're mandated to have to give people tickets on other airlines and all the other stuff that the federal government has done to them. My question is, does the law provide for an act of God thing for Delta or not? I'm thinking maybe for or not.
I would think or not, because, you know, I don't dig too deeply into if I'm going to get reimbursed when there's a weather issue or anything. I just travel a lot, and I just know that that's the kind of thing that's going to happen to me. But I don't know if they get a provision in there because, you know, there's a tornado warning at O'Hare and everybody's got to go down in the walkway area. Does Delta American and of course in Chicago it's going to be Do American or United have to compensate you for being late because of something like that versus they didn't put enough duct tape on the fuselage? And
well, there's a shot. You
know, I've actually got a picture of them doing that on a flight before I left for somewhere once.
And you got on it anyway?
Well, I got on it anyway. Yeah, it was going to China. You got to figure they knew what they were doing.
Yeah, you were already on the plane.
I've got a picture. It was from 10 years ago because my wife and I continue to joke about that they were literally putting duct tape on the bottom of the plane before I flew to China.
Well, and I could see, you know, sitting in the seat, they do that.
Yep.
Doors locked, closed, and all of a sudden it's just the new variation on the famous Twilight Zone one with a little gremlin on the plane.
Oh yeah, he's pulling off the duct tape.
Yeah, so this is just a new variation on it. That you want to get me off of here, get me out. They used duct tape, and everybody's like, "Nah, they didn't use duct tape."
Well, they had a
that makes me a young William Shatner.
Yeah,
how about it?
Well, yeah. he was young in there.
Overly dramatic, you say?
Yeah.
I should
just start talking like that.
Remember the.
Please don't.
Well, back in the day, they used to call them, they weren't the shuttles. The shuttle was New York to Washington, but they had an American was every a half hour to New York, and United was on the hour or something, Chicago to New York. And mm-hmm. they had these planes. They were old 727s, which I really loved to fly on. They were pretty cool. They would just fly back and forth to New York all day. So Dr. J got me into the, make sure you check before you go to the airport how many people are on the plane. Because if there's not very many people, he goes, they're going to cancel it.
Yeah.
Because if the plane's going to go out and there's nobody to come back, they're saying, screw it, there's another one in an hour anyway. So I'm leaving one of these board meeting things. I go out to Newark, and there's my plane gets canceled. Now the next plane is this DC-10 where they're trying to put all these people on, and the thing actually has a problem. And I see these two guys on one of those, lifting things, up trying to fix the tail of the DC-10, and I'm going, there's no way these two idiots are going to fix the tail of a DC-10 in a half hour. There was something wrong with the tail. It didn't want to move. The rudder didn't want to move. I'm thinking, not only are they not... So sure enough, now they've got the 727 that was canceled. Now the DC-10, which had probably 200 people on it because it was going onward to Denver, that's canceled. So I immediately see everybody running for the counters, and I'm a little clever than that. I head for the phone. I was able to get on the next plane ahead of the guys who were in line at the counter, so I only had to wait like 2 hours. But, I mean, it used to be a big joke to see how many of those planes per day they would cancel, because all the plane did was fly back and forth to New York, right? Mm-hmm. And if they didn't have people both ways, but the same thing happened to Lou last week when he was coming back from Germany. They didn't have enough people on the plane from Poland to go to Lufthansa, so they stuck him on a plane to Poland. He was 20 hours late.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it was... So, yeah. Russell, were you listening at all?
All right, I'm going to leave you guys to it, and I will catch up to you on Friday.
Yep. Right. Russell, we were talking about, we've been talking about the split in wealth in the economy. It's been happening for a long time, and it seems like it's really gotten worse or better, depending on where you are, with the COVID situation. And we were just talking about how when people are paying these athletes, and, you know, it's obviously a club, you know, the football and baseball people. But what do you think if you were doing the 10-year plan for like a new stadium and paying somebody a 10-year contract and all those kinds of things, what do you suppose your view of the world going forward for 10 years is in terms of revenue and everything versus, you know, the regular schlump? Is it, are they, you know, the, are these revenues going to continue to go up the way they have? Are the seat prices going to continue? I mean, I don't even know how I would do that if I was given that assignment. That's what I used to do for a living. I mean, I don't know where I'd get those assumptions.
You take, you know, you would take what have you been historically able to do relative to what goes on in the macro economy. There are years that you're not going to be able to raise your, you know, you raise your ticket prices. I think that's pretty obvious. But, you know, the majority, and I did hear Kevin talking about how the majority of the revenue really is, you know, from TV and from advertising, et cetera. And so you've got a pretty good idea of what your known revenue stream is going to be. And it's not ticket sales. Ticket sales tend to only, ticket sales don't really vary a whole lot year over year over year for just about all teams. The only time that they do a little bit, you know, that they do vary is when teams make the playoffs, because there's a bump there. You're able to raise your prices a little bit more, and you're able to get people to commit to next year's season tickets if they're going to get playoff tickets.
Let's assume you get a home game.
That's the wild card. And so typically, that's why you see teams right now going through the process of you know, trading up for somebody really good that's going to increase their salary a bit, because there's a belief they're going to be able to offset that salary with the increased revenue from tickets. But otherwise, everybody's got a pretty good known revenue stream.
Well, do you have a... I don't really have any idea, but we could probably find this out easy. There must be some sort of a split on the home ticket prices, because now some people make the playoffs and the whole 2 out of 3 series is away. So you're not even guaranteed a home game, even in baseball. And clearly you're not in football. So
Right.
So, I mean, I wonder how much, I mean, if you get 3 or 4, I guess you can only get 3 home playoff games if you're the Bears, you would think that would be a massive. Now, the prices, I know in baseball, for the playoff games are set by the NFL. I don't think you
can. By the league, yeah.
I don't think. But I got to believe that a lot of that money is going to go to the Bears. Now, how much of it goes to the visiting team, I don't have a clue. It's probably findable on Google, but...
I think there's some sort of common split in place for all of that. But it's not necessarily just the ticket sales for the extra game. It's the ability to raise your prices the following year because they were good. Yeah. And, you know, I know somebody that worked out an arbitrage where they committed to White Sox season tickets the year after they went to the World Series, and they were able to... cover, I don't know, they were basically able to cover their next year season tickets by reselling a couple of the World Series tickets and going to one game or something along those
lines.
Well,
that same thing happened with the Cub people. I mean, they always say, well, I mean, you made so much the 1 year, but you know, you don't. I found, as a matter of fact, I don't know if he's your buddy, Tom Ricketts, he was speaking at the security traders thing. This is...
Uh-huh.
Way before 2016, when I still had my season tickets, and he, you know, then they were doing this rebuilding and all this kind of crap, and I said, I raised my hand like I didn't normally do in class. He said, "What, you know, question?" I've been a season ticket holder for like a really long time, and I said, "I know you've been involved for a long time, and now you own the place. And congratulations on that." I said, "But I think you know, being a trader on the floor, that I'm really your wholesaler. I mean, I'm buying 81 games, and, you know, I have a real job. So if I make it to 20, that's a lot. So I really have to sell. I mean, Big Dan and I used to split them. So Dan would go to 20. You know, I'd go to 20, and then we would sell the other 40. You know, we never made any money on it. He had his group of people that wanted 10 tickets, and I had some guys from the floor that wanted them. And we were essentially wholesalers for him, right? Because nobody goes to 81 games. It has a life. So I said, you know, it's reaching a point now where I'm paying you at the beginning of the year. I cannot get face value for these tickets in a lot of these games. The team is so horrible. I said, so I'm willing to be your wholesaler. I'm not willing to take a hit for you, you know, to buy tickets at 40 when I can only sell them at 30. I said, you know, you're reaching the point on these prices where if they go up much higher, you're going to lose me, because I'm willing to go to the games and pay, but I'm not willing to take a hit. And where the list price is greater than the market price. And I said, and you know what I'm talking about. You were a trader on the floor. You know, and shakes his head, oh, yeah, I really understand that. But then they've done straight up since then. So he didn't exactly pay attention.
Yeah. But and that's that, you know, and you also, you bring up the revenue thing, you know, they, you always have the new stadium effect. So if you're planning out 10 years, if you're the Bears, you're planning on having a new stadium one way or another in the next, within the next decade. And that's why they push for new stadiums.
I'm going to say that they don't get a new stadium.
Not within a decade? I can make an argument for over under 10 years that they're playing in a new stadium right now.
For either
side of it, you know.
All we have to do is somebody find a reporter that has access to, I'm going to say the Tribune, we don't really need that anymore, who can get the numbers, and it's probably pretty easy to do, or estimate the numbers, the 20-some years since this place has been built in this, and say how much the Bears made every year and what their rent is and how much the population still owes. And here's what they want to do with the new place. I don't see any citizen. You start talking about a place making $150, $200 million a year and paying $6 million in rent and crying about it. I don't know. The biggest Bear fan in the world wants to give them any more money.
No.
But
not till they do something good.
Well, but even so, I mean, what difference does it make? Why can't they pay their own way? I mean, the Sox pay $1 million a year.
They get a special civic pride thing, and then they can, leverage. Or I started to say Aurora because I'm in Aurora right now. Arlington Heights against the city. You know, they can pit the city against Arlington Heights back and forth.
Well, yeah, but it ends up coming out of.
So that's you can bitch and whine, but you know, if you just absolutely love going to the Bears games and you've been going, you're like, you know, been going for most of your life and tailgating with the same people and everything else, you're gonna want things to turn out, you know, well, and that the team stays where you let them to stay and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, it is after all just a business, you know. And hey, what do you make of we have to talk a little bit as we get the futures up 359 and NASDAQ, because they were down almost that much last night. Kevin was asking me earlier about what is this kind of movement back and forth with these numbers that people can't even, I mean, we're talking about a 30-point move in Microsoft, where it was down 35 last night. Now it's only down 9. We're talking $210 billion in market cap, just flipping around here.
Yeah.
I mean, is this a healthy market that's just trying to find its way? Is it not a healthy market? Are these numbers so big, people don't even know what the damn they're trading? I was listening to some people yesterday talking about how the on CNBC effort to close it. Microsoft was down at the time like 25. But that's okay. The Russell was up something. And I'm like, Microsoft.
They have nothing to do with each other.
Yeah, Microsoft is just down 3 times the market cap of the entire Russell. I mean, we're not even talking about apples versus watermelons here, for God's sake. I mean,
The market cap of the Russell is 3,000. I'm sorry, is 3 trillion.
I thought the market cap.
I looked it up like 2 days ago.
I was talking about the IWM, the market cap of the IWM.
The IWM ETF is much smaller than that.
Yeah.
The overall market cap of the Russell 2000 is about the same as Apple right now.
Okay.
That's where they fall in line.
So you're talking about all 2,000 stocks. They're not all in the ETF. I was talking about the IWM.
Well, they're all in the ETF as well, but I'm just talking about the actual. If you bought all the stocks in the Russell 2000, it would cost about as much as completely buying out Apple or Nvidia. They're all kind of they're kind of in the same range, depending on what's going on from day to day. And you know, you talk about, you know, Microsoft having a 30-point move. Well, that's not even a 1% move.
Yeah, it is. 30 points like 8%. It's $400. So 30 points like 7.5% or something.
Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, not a 10%, but right. I'm getting my digits all mixed up.
That's all right. We're getting old. What can I tell you?
Yeah. So, the typical their typical move off of earnings has been about between $5 and $20. Of course, the overnight stuff has subsided now, and that $9 is, that's kind of a drop in the bucket relative to the stock price. So it's not huge, but you talk about this every earnings season, and the issue with earnings is laws, and the laws or the earnings reactions, and the laws are if I work for Microsoft. If I worked for their investor relations department, I'm talking to the Microsoft analyst over at Smith Barney, and I accidentally say, "Well, our sales were a little light last quarter," and that's not public knowledge yet. I got to share that with the whole, with the whole investing public.
Allegedly,
immediately. That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to. I know what that. Well, that's the law. The Reg FD law is you need to as quickly as possible make that information public. So they did clamp down on leaking out information. So information, used to start to have stocks drift in one direction or another when we led up to earnings, and now you get more of this knee-jerk reaction. And the reason you get this knee-jerk reaction is it's more difficult for the companies to start dropping hints as to whether things are going to be good or bad leading up to the earnings announcement. So that you see, and then. Another one that comes up an awful lot, and I can't believe I'm the only person in the world that seems to talk about this very much. This was Microsoft's fourth quarter. And the fourth quarter, Microsoft, any company, when they report their fourth quarter and year-end earnings, the CEO, the CFO, and maybe even some other people have to sign off on those. And if they get prosecuted for known falsities in the earnings announcement, it's not the quarterly announcement, it's the end of year announcement. So companies are going to be more honest in the fourth quarter announcement than the first, second, or third quarter announcements. And it's been a while since I've run the numbers, but I've run the numbers, and fourth quarter announcements tend to be more volatile than the other three.
I think Microsoft is so above the law on just about everything they do, antitrust or whatever, that I don't think they worry about that. Although there's no the guy does not want to sign a fake return. That part I get, but
right. And it used to be the companies could lie, and there really wasn't a legal process in place to put one of the officers in jail for lying.
Name me the attorney general that has a clue about what you're talking about and could actually put the cuffs on one of these people.
Oh, none of them.
Well, actually, somebody just paid a big fine. Was it the headline today? Who the hell was it? Was it wasn't telephone?
That's it.
Who was it? Somebody just paid a big fine for Walgreens for not.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Really? Huh.
No. Walgreens. But I mean, I guess all this stuff kind of comes together, Russell. I mean, the Microsoft. I have them at 13 times revenue now, and I did a few weeks ago, so I should do that again before I lob that out there, but. I just looked; they're 36 times earnings, so they're at a level here where an oopsie is a big deal. If they were 20 times revenue or a PE like maybe they have been their whole career, and their revenue was times earnings was 8, I wouldn't even. But all these things are at these pivotal kind of prices, and people think that they belong there. And then you hear, Carl talking about all the different stuff they do. That is now clearly against any kind of law, where they're gone from you've been able to buy these software products to where you have to pay them by the month, and the stuff that's on there becomes their property that you can't get it back or something. If the thing conks out, you can't get like your drawings. It wasn't Microsoft. It might have been Adobe. I think it was Adobe. Isn't Adobe where people do all their artsy, craftsy stuff on?
Yeah.
You said if you drop your monthly, whatever it is you're paying, all of a sudden your stuff disappears. It's your stuff.
Yeah, you can. I mean, I'm fortunate enough. I work at a university where they pay for that for me. But I know exactly what you're talking about. If I were to go change jobs, I need to make sure I've got all of my documents and all my Adobe stuff that I've created using the, and I use it for videos I create. So I know for a fact that I would have to that I got to get all those files. Another funny thing is if you work for a corporation and they pay for your Microsoft Word, my understanding is anything you create with Word, they could claim they own it.
The corporation or Microsoft?
Yeah, no, the corporation.
Yeah, well, probably.
Yeah.
Hey, so I gotta,
if I write the book that I'm writing right now, I've got to use I got to use my own Microsoft Word, or Indiana's going to take it away.
What big question today for the world traveling professor? Mm-hmm. Japanese yen. Well, actually, it's come back a little bit. What is it's down 2.5 to 150.24. That's 150 yen to the dollar, correct?
Mm-hmm.
What is 1.75%? It was 2%. 1.75% in a currency in a day. That's a life breaker. Yeah. If you're,
that is. I mean, their annualized volatility is usually in the single digits, and when you're looking at a 1% move, that right there is kind of the equivalent of a 16% annual standard deviation. So you go up to 2. That's pretty huge. I mean, that's bigger than a lot of emerging stock markets.
I mean, what if some poor guy over there bought dollars yesterday at the, or I mean, if you bought the yen, you made out like a bandit, right?
So if the yen's losing value?
No, yeah, I'm saying if you bought, $1 was equal to 163 yen, mm-hmm, 2 weeks ago. So if I gave him a buck and I got 163 yen in my pocket, yeah, I can turn around and buy the dollar back for 150 and I have 13 yen for change. That's incredible in 2 weeks.
That's kind of like trading earnings.
But we're talking about companies that do billions of dollars a transaction. What do we import from Japan? We've got to do like some.
Well, they're all using forward contract. They're all. It's not necessarily what they're having to exchange today, as much as what they're having to kind of lock in for exchange rates 3, 6, 9 months out in the future.
But even so, you just.
And
but you can change the forward contract. You can trade those.
Yeah. No. And so they're having to lock in a less favorable rate if it's moving against them, and they have to make a decision at some point. Are we willing to lock this rate in 9 months down the road based on what's going on right now?
But if I locked in 163 yen for the dollar in say September, I got a massive winner. I can reverse that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you can even if you're contracting over the counter, you can just do an offsetting transaction.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you could, you know,
but
if things have moved in your direction. But that's not why, yeah, you brought up the corporate finance part. That's not really what the corporate finance people are supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be hedging, not speculating on it. We'll probably find a couple of firms in the next 6 months to a year that blew themselves up one way or another by getting on the wrong side of the yen or not properly hedging the yen because it was moving around so much.
Well, I'm going to... Yeah. I actually have going back forever, a little bit of experience at this, Russell, because my stepfather used to do this because they used to buy... You read the story yesterday, so I'll be short. He was a chief financial officer of Hallmark Watches... No, Walton Watches and Hallmark Rings. And they bought all the they bought all the movements from Switzerland. And they would routinely, because they, you know, they were in debt to, it was a Continental Bank or somebody, Continental Bank would want them, because they say they buy all the Christmas watch movements for delivery in October, you know, and they spend the next month, you know, putting them in the watches over here, right here, the Canal Street, in one of those places, Clinton. And so the factory was actually an office building, a bunch of people sitting at the desk putting on watches together. And they would constantly buy the Swiss franc forward because then they could price their catalogs.
Yeah.
They knew just what they were paying. But I got to believe if he'd have bought a whole bunch of Swiss francs in July and the next day they were down 2.5%, he is not a happy camper. Massive move. I mean, when you're talking about millions of dollars on a transaction, it's not supposed to be. I mean, we're talking about guys doing this to lock in, you know, maybe one, you know, a half a percent or that kind of movement, not two in a day.
Yeah.
We saw like a regular guy.
No, so I mean, and that's why the corporations get in trouble, because you know, if a corporate finance, if your corporate finance department, you know, the accounting department or whatever you call it at your company, if they're supposed to be consistently hedging, you know, they may blow that. You know, they may not be used to this very volatile market that they're supposed to be hedging in, and basically make, for lack of a better way to put it, make some mistakes.
Well, you know, I don't know if I ever told you this story, but I don't know if I ever told the listeners, but we used to do a lot of stuff. When I say we, I never went down there, but my brother did a lot, and so did Dr. J. They were doing a lot of option teaching down in Mexico, and this is in the early 90s, right? And it was right about the time where they were going to actually list the peso contract on the CME, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, that there was going to be a peso future. And so, anyway, my brother's now president of PTI, just to show, you know, what a bright, good guy he is. He's down there, and they're going to put up a little exchange down there for futures. And my brother traded on the board of, board of trade, and, you know, he's a real bright guy, and that's why he's president of the firm. And so Dr. J calls me, and he goes, well, we had these guys now formed this exchange down there, and we helped them out. And I go, well, what do you mean you helped them out? He goes, I said, don't they have like some kind of a test or something? He goes, well, they didn't, but they do now. I said, don't tell me. He goes, yeah, they asked Dan to write the test for it. I guess he did a real nice job, which wouldn't surprise me. And so they a bunch of guys come up here for a option conference, right? And these are big schmoes. And we, you know, of course, we went to remember the Excelsior. On a Friday night after all this stuff, we're over there, you know, drinking the real stiff drinks. And I go, I just want to tell you guys, I feel bad. It was one of those weeks where they devalued the peso. And I said, I don't want to feel, you know, bad for you guys, because it's kind of crummy. They devalued it like 8% or something. This is right before they listed the contract. So they wanted to get it in their mind straight before they did. And I go, and the guy goes, what do you mean? And I said, well, it's not a good thing. Well, your people are now basically 8% poorer than they were earlier in the week on a world stage. We don't care about those guys. And I go, what do you mean? He said, well, we all knew it was coming. We're part of the, you know, the group that gets the memo. We moved all our cash over offshore on Tuesday night and brought it back on Wednesday. We're 8% richer. I'm going, there's an interesting way to look at the world, Russell. you couldn't write this crap, could you? Are you there?
Well, I'm here.
Yeah,
I'm
mean,
here.
Do you believe
you were on a tear there, man.
But do you believe that story? And he goes, yeah, we all knew about it. We moved our stuff overseas or offshore and brought it back the next morning, 8% richer.
Yeah, that happened. I mean, in my understanding, I if you ever talk to somebody that you know lives in one of these countries that has very volatile currencies. You know, and we've talked about one of the instructors at SIBO that would be very blunt with the foreign visitors.
Oh, God, yeah.
He was like, well, how do you can't manage all this currency stuff? I said, well, you know, we all see it coming. We go into dollars, and then our currency depreciates, and then we put it back into our local currency.
The haves and the have-nots. So, isn't it better to be a have, and, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The haves kind of know what they're up to. On the other side of it, I went to when Trump took over. There were two people in my cohort from Mexico, and because of what happened with the currencies, their tuition went up by like 50% for their last year in pesos.
Well, you know, the same guy you're talking about, we had some people here that were affiliated with PTI, I mean, way, way back. They didn't do anything on the security side, but they had some futures stuff, and they would actually sell, you know, spot grain to China, and they were involved with the agriculture department, and even though, you know, we're always fighting back and forth with China, at least back then, everybody was trying to be nice. So they would send a group over here of like 10 people, and half of them were you know, the party. But everybody was young. They were all like, you know, 28 to 32. They were young party people, and they'd come over here, and we would take them. We took them on a barge tour. We took them to the ethanol plant. One guy gave a lecture on crop insurance and all the stuff we do here to help farmers out. That was part of the deal.
Yeah.
You know, and so we go to this dinner, and some of the people from the SIBO were there, including the guy you're talking about. And he goes, say, it was up at the Buckingham restaurant. We had to cook in there, make up a big dinner and so forth. So he goes, so, hey, what do you guys think about this Taiwan issue?
Oh yeah, no, I know he would do that every time.
But you know, they were ready for it, Russell. The one girl who was in charge.
Oh, I know they were.
The one girl who was in charge.
Yeah,
and she goes.
I know exactly who you're talking about. Who was in charge too? She had all the great canned answers immediately.
Oh yeah.
They're Taiwan's coming back into the fold any day now.
They're like the adolescent child that breaks away from a while, but then they always come back, type of thing. I'm thinking there was one. There was, boy, she didn't write that. Somebody wrote it for her, but she was ready.
Yeah.
No,
that they have the canned answers on all of those things. And what's funny is, yeah, I've got a really nice, you know, first off, China never, ever ruled Taiwan, ever. It's not like it's historically coming back into the fold or anything like that. It's never been part of it. They just feel like it should be part of it because there are a lot of Chinese people there. And because that's where the competing government ran off to when the nationalists lost to the communists. But there's no historic reason that China should has any claim whatsoever to Taiwan. And I've got a really beautiful poster that I bought that shows Taiwan, and then it's a map, and it shows what we refer to as China, referred to as West Taiwan.
Well, you know,
if China can claim Taiwan, Taiwan can claim China. Well, not that they would want it.
You know, part of the backstory of that, and I'll take a couple minutes because it's sort of interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know you're you know a lot about World War II, and economically, we've all at least talked a little bit about the Marshall Plan in Europe. You know, George Marshall. As a matter of fact, you know, when the show first started, we had a guest, a lady. It was a tough interview because she was on the phone, she barely talked, but she had to be in her late 80s. But she was one of the younger girls that went over as part of the Marshall Plan. She was with George Marshall.
Oh, wow.
She was one of his. And I said, you know, you get this idea that Europe was, you know, kind of a mess, and all of a sudden the Marshall Plan comes in and everything was sort of okay. And she goes, oh no. It was every town. There was nothing, not much to eat. The buildings were crushed. There was no food. Nobody had a job. She was every town. People are fighting. There's this mob against that mob. She was every single town was a fight for a year or so before we got everything, you know, at least making some progress where so enough people had some work to do and some rebuilding to where they weren't all, you know, drunk and fighting all day. She goes, but in the meantime, after the war, when all this bad crap was happening, I think the guy who was put in charge of Europe was Morgenthau. He was a treasury guy, and he did kind of a horse bleep job. But George Marshall was a very special man in terms of being able to plan stuff out. But he left. He retired. He was, you know, he was older. He went home. He got in his car, drove home, and when he was driving up the driveway, the phones ringing. It's Harry Truman. Hey, you got to come back here. I got a job for you in China. And he goes, what do you mean China? Well, him and his wife went to China, if I'm saying pushing a year. And his job was to try and negotiate a peace between Mao Zedong and Chiang Kai-shek. And he went, like he did, he put his nose into everything. He went back and forth, back and forth. Finally said Truman a letter. He goes, these two guys are essentially morons. There's no chance I'm ever going to get anywhere. They don't care how many people they kill. Yeah. They hate each other. And if you know, 1,000 people die today, neither one could care less. He goes, there's no talking to him. And Truman said, okay, basically get your ass back here. I got another job for you in Europe. And that's when he went on. But there was like a period of time, and that's essentially what happened. Mao won and got the mainland, and Chiang Kai-shek's people scurried off to Taiwan, right? And they became...
Yeah.
I mean, for a long time... Yeah. Well, here's where Chinese mainland's pissed off. For a long time, they weren't considered China. Taiwan was. Remember, because even in the United Nations,
it was reversed. Yeah,
but a lot of people probably don't remember that. You remember, it's probably on YouTube somewhere. Where on TV, they booted the Taiwanese guy off the what's the part of the few people the veto power? What's they call it? What's that committee in the UN? The U.S., Russia, France, and anybody can veto the thing.
Talking about the Security Committee?
Yeah, Security Council. Well,
yeah, Security Council.
Those guys. Taiwan was on. They were the China that was on the Security Council.
They were China, and now they're not.
But they got booted out, and they showed the one guy like having to get rousted out of his chair, and the other guy sat down. And what a film that was! Here, you're out. Here's our other guy comes in, and the guy, you know, we kicked him in the ass pretty much on the way out. Mm-hmm. Could you imagine that being on TV? It was.
Yeah, it's all about the ceremony and et cetera.
Right. So we've danced
and
all
around. Of Susan Church. Oh, yeah. Do you notice that? You probably don't, but this drives me nuts too. Since we're on the Taiwan thing, you know, they're not. They, if you look at the medal count, Taiwan's flag is an Olympic flag.
Really? I did not know that.
Yep, and this is where I start to get real, and it's to appease the Chinese. If you go to PGA.com and you look at like the golfers, you know, the weekly tournament, and if it's one of the graphics where they have the flags to show where the golfers are from, if you've got a golfer from Taiwan, they use the Olympic flag.
Wow.
They don't even in China, and that's what China has tried to do over a long period of time. Is they've done just done this creep thing, and I talked about going to Hong Kong, and every year I go to Hong Kong, you could tell that China was creeping in there, creeping in, and now they've ruined it. And you know, Taiwan takes a look at what they did with Hong Kong, and they're like, we don't ever want those guys running what we do here, ever, because they're just gonna they're going to introduce communism with Chinese characteristics, which is basically nothing more than, you know, treating your people horribly and pretending like you have a market economy, and when the market economy doesn't work, introducing more rules to try to make it work better, which actually have the opposite effect. There's your there's communism with Chinese characteristics.
Well,
it's
like people, you know. Not to wander into politics, but people talk about, you know, Chicago politics being democratic and how it's all screwed up because they're Democrats. It's not democratic. It's an empire, or it was. I mean, it's the people in charge. Well, it seems to have changed who the people are, but the people in China, they don't care if they're communistic or not. It's the people up top make all the dough. I mean, whatever name you want to put on it. I mean, it's certainly not Lenin's communism, is it? I wouldn't think. But anyway, all right, we don't have that much time here, Russell. What is going on?
No, we do not. And I'm doing a little multitasking.
What are we doing on now? We're up 400 points in NASDAQ. Microsoft came out and said all the money they're spending on this AI, they're not wasting all of it or anything like that. I'm not telling anybody to sell.
Yes,
Microsoft.
They are. How are you going to make money on AI?
Well, okay, that would have been my editorial comment too. But they were down 35. Now they're down 6. All the rest of the guys who were down with them, they're all up. I mean, NVIDIA traded 100 yesterday, or damn near, and now it's 111. So it's had this huge bounce. It buy the dip, and there was somebody on TV last week said, every dip, you got to buy the dip. Nothing's changed. The Fed has your back. Don't worry about valuations. Don't worry about anything. Just buy the dip because the Fed has your back. And by the way, it looks like he's right again today, at least for today. Now, but we also, you and I, moves to the upside of 3% and 4% and aren't exactly all that healthy either for a market, you know, that is
it's
a bull market.
Already overvalued.
And what do you make of this? Does this make you nervous? It does me, but I'm not gonna tell anybody to sell it.
We talked about when we hit the tipping points and not being able to really predict the tipping points. But the one thing that we do know is the more overvalued the market is, and the more the sillier it seems to be on the upside, is the harder the crash whenever we do get whatever catalyst pushes us lower. So we're just setting ourselves up for, you know, for nastier and nastier downside at some point in the future.
What do you make of this, like the stuff like the gold and those kinds of in this Bitcoin situation? We were talking about with Carl yesterday, and I don't want to go into it, but it's Trump came out last week and said something about all the Bitcoin that the government has I won't say stolen.
They basically took it away from people that were doing bad stuff with it.
So what did they do?
Yeah, so I don't want to say they actually stole it. I don't think they stole it. What they did was
confiscate.
I mean, there was a marketplace where if I had wanted to have somebody slash your tires, I probably could have found somebody and paid them some Bitcoin to slash your tires. They were doing much more extreme stuff than that.
So if that was you, they waterboarded you until you gave them your password, and now the government has your password as their Bitcoin, essentially.
It's their Bitcoin, and then there's much like, you know, if I were, I don't know, you know, if I were doing what the guy that owned my car before me was doing and pimping, if I'm using my car pimping, and they, you know, they can say it was used in a crime, and by saying that it was used in a crime, they can take it away from me and then auction it off. They're kind of doing the same thing with the Bitcoin.
But unless they have your key,
yeah,
how can they?
But you have to give. I mean, that's much like if you get prosecuted of something, they're gonna force you to give them the key.
Because this intrigues me, because if ever it's just like
they're gonna force you. You know, if I do something and I get fined $500,000, one way or another, the government's, you know, there's going to be some sort of methodology for them to get that money out of me. It's the same thing.
Why? Because I don't buy the fact that this. I mean, I'm just being a grumpy old dude here. But for instance, one of my lawyer buddies had a I'll say had, because the had would be the right term, a client who evidently ordered a hit on somebody, and it's a big case here in Chicago, but I won't go into it. And in broad daylight. And now, suppose this guy, who had nothing but money, evidently, had $2 million in Bitcoin. All right. So 2 days later, what do you suppose happens? He gets taken out.
I guess, yeah.
So now all of a sudden, now the way the Bitcoin people talk about it, other than maybe him telling you or me over a beer some night, not that we'd ever have a beer with this guy, that, by the way, I got $2 million in Bitcoin. How does anybody find his Bitcoin if he dies with his password and something?
They don't. They don't. And that's one of the things that happens and continues to happen. And there's actually a little cottage industry of people trying to figure out how to get to people's Bitcoin once something like that happens. And there's some guy, and I don't even want to make up numbers, because the numbers apparently are kind of ridiculous, but there's one person that was early in the Bitcoin thing, and everything is stuck on a hard drive that they think is in a landfill somewhere. And they've actually tried to extract that. But there will, you know, much like, you probably never did it, but, you know, the Federal Reserve in Chicago, they've got a little museum there just across the street from the Board of Trade. And there's a guy that does a tour about, you know, just what the Fed does. And he talks about the cash in the system. And he said, you know, he breaks down where all the cash is. You know, a certain amount of it's in the bank, certain amount of it's, you know, the Fed always keeps extra cash around, and this is an older presentation before everybody paid electronically. But, you know, we would make sure we have more cash around the holiday weekends, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, and, you know, they're between 2-5% of currency has just disappeared.
Well, it's probably in somebody's,
There's a house near where we go up in Lake Geneva. They went to do work on the house, and when they started tearing up the drywall, there was money all inside of the wall. It was a former outfit guy's house. When they found that, first off, if you're the contractor, don't freaking tell anybody. But when you find it, you get to, the government's going to confiscate it and then just probably apply it somewhere else. So it's I feel like when Bitcoin has been confiscated by the government like that for legal proceedings, I hope that it was justified. But also, if I was, you know, one of the bad guys, they're going to say, we're going to give you 20 years in jail here, and if you don't turn over your key and stuff, we're going to give you 50. They're going to do something that makes, you know, that convinces you you need to share that.
Why am I so suspicious about human nature? It must be my Chicago upbringing that you can't.
Well, it's not just that. It's just that, you know, walk down the street and you'll be suspicious of human nature. Doesn't take a whole lot these days.
Well, the idea that all this money is going to be lost in the system and nobody's going to find a way. Like my brother Dan, again, president of he decides he wants to get some Bitcoin one day, right? So there's a vending machine. You and I could have bought one of these vending machines years ago.
I know. No, MK, a common acquaintance of us two, bought 20 Bitcoin from one of those machines back when it was under a dollar.
Well, my brother bought 20 bucks
worth. I hope he's not still carrying it around in his wallet.
Oh, yeah. Well, my brother bought 20 bucks worth, which actually the fee was like 6.25, so he actually got like $13.75 worth,
yeah.
And which makes a great deal if you own that machine, right? So he, of course, he doesn't have the key anymore. I can't believe that 20 years from now, nobody's going to find a way to see all these ones that haven't been touched for 15 years and somehow find a way to get them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that's the aura around this thing.
I feel like at some point there'll be an accounting of how much is out there and how much. And the other thing is, you can take your Bitcoin off the network and put it into cold storage, so it's very difficult to actually see exactly how much Bitcoin is being actively utilized or actively accessed, or people can actually have access to. But you got to assume at some point, way, way, way out into the future, they'll do something around those amounts.
Well, if stuff becomes legitimate, we got to dash here, Russell. Wait a minute. How about how the dogs? Give me the dog report.
Dogs are doing well. The baby dog that's going to go out for adoption had herself fixed up yesterday and is walking around with a cone. But she's going to make somebody a really happy dog. We did all the photo shoot stuff for them to put her up for adoption, and when that happens, I will let everybody know. Hopefully the person that listens to us in the western suburbs near us would be willing to adopt her so we can still see her every once in a while.
All you got to do is go out in the morning and see him walking her. Listening to us.
I know. Well, if we did do that, odds are that dog would attack any larger dog that she has. That's the one thing. She's one of those little dogs that think she's a big dog.
Oh, God. Maggie, Audrey's little one. Yeah. She's 18 with, like, two teeth. Let me at him. Maggie, what are you doing? But my question I have is, how long can we hang with essentially two sets of rules if Bitcoin becomes more and more of a thing, which it obviously is, how is it can you have a firm like PTI, which when I say like PTI, like everybody in the financial industry, if you're a client, Russell, and your statements come back like 2 months in a row, I have to, or Dan or my nephew or somebody here has PTI, has to get on the phone and track your ass down and say, what'd you do, move? Because if it's like 3 or 4 months and we can't find you, that money's going to the Secretary of State. You know, RBC is going to kick it off. It's like your bank. If your bank can't find you for 6 months and the stuff comes back and you don't tell them you moved, that stuff's going to go right to the Secretary of State as being abandoned. I don't know if it's 6 months or 8 months, but it's pretty damn fast. How is it, can you have a competing system where nobody ever gets anything? I mean, how can a Bitcoin exist legitimately when they don't pay attention to any of the rules that everybody else has to live with every day? I mean, I don't know how you, at what point do you say, the more you legitimize it, the more you have to say, okay, well, here are the rules. And none of the rules even seem to match at all, do they?
They have rules as far as the creation and transferring back and forth, and the rules are enforced by the consensus of everybody on the Bitcoin network, supposedly, but that does not mean that it's not really But what happens when people break the rules?
Well, but those are their rules. They're not our government's rules. Yeah. I mean, rules,
no, there aren't any government. And what happens when government creates rules that for something that really is borderless? The U.S. passes a specific law with respect to Bitcoin, but Bitcoin it operates inside and outside the U.S. borders on a very consistent basis, and you really never know whether it's within or without your jurisdiction.
But I mean, how do you do that? Well, I guess we got to dash, but part of its allure is it's outside of, quote, the banking system. Okay, but now they want to be legit. And if they want to be legit to where you and I can go out and buy a hot dog with a Bitcoin, how do you stay out of that system?
Yeah, they want you outside the system, but then at the same time, they want ETFs to be able to buy it.
Yeah. Anyway, all right, buddy. As usual, good stuff.
I totally agree with you on that one.
The God, it's have a nice. Are you here? Oh, you're here. What are you doing in Aurora? That toddling town.
I'm sitting with my wife's car for 5 hours while it gets fixed this morning.
Oh God. Well, hope you got your laptop.
The poor guy. I actually was doing the paperwork and talking to you at the same time.
All right.
So
well, have a good day.
I was going to do the paperwork, but we never took a break.
Oh, God. No, we didn't. I'll blame Andrew for that.
I timed the thing for the break, and we never went on break.
Is this the buy the dip of all time? S&P Futures now up 70, NASDAQ is up 412. The best buy the dip ever, this could be. We'll be back tomorrow.
Until next week.
We'll be back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.